And also, hi, this is Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. I'm Paul McInnes, and on this week's show, Andy Bell chimes in with his thoughts on two decades of erasure and the 80s electro revival. We review new music from Mavado, Wild Birds and Peace Drums, and Star Death and White Dwarfs. We'll have your face back, and we'll be boning up on Os Mutantes. But first, we re-enter the world of Bat for Lashes. That was Daniel by Bat for Lashes, the first single from her new double album, Two Suns. Just like the sun, Rosie Swash lights up my life. And joins me here today, Rosie, Natasha Khan, was the guest on our very second podcast. Then she was up and coming, now she's fated. How did that happen then?
Well, she's definitely evolved her spiritual side. For one, if that was even possible. But I think the big thing on this album, which people said were missing a little bit from the first, is she's evolved her pop side. She's got some really huge pop hooks on this one, as well as a lot of experimentation, big range of sounds, collaboration with the Aesir, Scott Walker and all that sort of stuff. She's kind of the pop star that everyone really wanted her to be this time around. And she recorded a lot of this all over the place, Joshua Tree National Park, New York, Brighton. So when I met up with her earlier this week to talk about Two Suns, the album, I wanted to know, first off, how much of that landscape influenced her sound?
I think landscape is obviously quite an important factor in both of my albums so far, whether they're sort of internal landscapes of my own imagination or something that is inspired by an external physical landscape. And so on this record, I think sort of actually being in the desert and experiencing like those massive skies and stars and the light of the full moon, like when there's no electricity around, sort of dull it, and being sort of in New York and right in the grit and like the mad sort of electricity of the city. I think it was kind of seeping into me all the time, and I'm always documenting and illustrating, like drawing things and writing things down and kind of putting things in my sketchbook. And I think taking pictures and making films of those places, taking pictures of Pearl in New York and putting it in my book, it's almost like a little art project of mine visually, that then when I come home and I feel more relaxed and like safe and in my own space, I can write music, because I can't really write music on the road or out anywhere. It has to be like in my bed with my little machine, and I've got quite a sort of strict sort of, not a rule, but like, you know, the environment has to be just so. I'm like a little lily or something. I can't survive elsewhere. And so what was good is that I can absorb those influences visually, and when I bring them back, then musically they're there for me.
You're big into sort of storytelling and characters in a quite a spectral way, and how much of that is an extension of, you know, childhood playing and letting your imagination run free, and you sort of trying to get back to that place where there was no barriers to where your imagination could go?
I think that perhaps I never really lost the desire for escapism. I just think as a kid I was really believed in fairies, and I don't even know if I really truly believed in them, but I wanted to, and I was always testing, like I wanted to prove that it existed. So I'd write like miniature letters, like the size of like the tiniest fingernail you could imagine, with like the tiniest words on, and put them under my pillow, and I'd keep little matchboxes with like little skeletons of tiny insects, and I was just like obsessed with miniature things, and or obsessed with like talking to things I was imagining in the dark, and witches and ghosts and stuff. And I think even though as I got older, I kind of realised logically that perhaps they don't exist, I don't think I ever fully believe that they don't exist. Like there's always that one element of doubt where, you know, something might turn up one day. And also, I think sort of having a religious upbringing and also reading a lot as a child, I think I've always loved like the human need to kind of turn human stories into fables almost, like kind of adapt like our experiences into something more fantastical with different types of imagery. And when I read like early Greek myths or just like Bibles or whatever, you know, like these crazy floods and big giants with one eye and like all these sort of weird things. It's just really nice as a metaphor to be able to understand those things on a kind of gut level as a human, but you get this kind of beautiful storytelling construct. This record's more emotional and more human in a way. Like it's sort of, it's not as storytelling. And I think the last record is very much imbued with that sense of like metaphors and symbolism and everything, which I really love. And it's quite childlike. But I feel like this record's a little bit more direct with its emotions. And there's more of a balance between those sort of fantastical imagery, but also some quite straightforward songs with quite straightforward lyrics. And I think for me, Daniel was like one of the most terrifying ones to do because it just didn't have that much fantastical imagery. It was just more about a real emotion I was feeling. And it was also the most kind of poppy and accessible, which is quite weird for me because I'm used to sort of mysticking it all up, you know, and kind of, you know, using magic and everything. And I love that because it makes me feel so excited. But it was a different type of excitement. It was like a more real excitement, which has made me feel more vulnerable. So I do feel like I push the boundaries personally for myself into territories that I felt quite shy about, but I made myself do it. Daniel, when I first saw you, I knew that you had a flame in your heart. And under wild blue skies,
talk to you a bit about the collaborations on this record. When I read that you had worked with Yesaya, I felt like then, although I was probably looking into it a bit too much, that I could hear that very much in the percussion of some of the songs. At what point did you start working with them, and how did that come about?
I actually started with them quite late. So, for example, like Two Planets is all my drum programming with the help of David Coston that I co-produced it with. But I had very specific ideas about the types of drums I wanted to use. And Glass, the first very original beat you hear, that's my drum, little drum machine. I made that beat. And then I asked Alex, who did the Radiohead tour with us, to. I knew that I wanted the drum roll. He kind of be like. So a lot of them didn't have Yesaya's sort of input, but I think just from me being in Brooklyn and kind of hearing a lot of that kind of tribal drumming with African and Asian and dancehall influences, and MIA had come out like a couple of years before, it was all kind of like happening over there, definitely influenced me. And when I brought Yesaya in, it was more to get some assistance in kind of pushing it just that little step further. So the drum beat you hear on Pearl's Dream, like the first 2 minutes is... For the first half of the song, it's all mine and David's drumming, programming. But then when all the... all that kind of like woohoo bit comes in, that's Chris from Yesaya, because he's such a badass, like, little jiggy, dancey person. Comes in with his like like his Quincy Jones sort of bass, and we were just having a right laugh, basically dancing around the studio and just being as cheesy as possible, and really enjoying the fact that I was sort of, all of us felt free, and that it was really cool to make something quite poppy, but like it felt really innovative and really fun.
And then was that a similar experience to the Scott Walker Celebration. No.
Yes, me and Scott did break dancing when we first met each other. It was completely different. I didn't actually meet Scott Walker. We just emailed each other because I wrote The Big Sleep very early on, and I always felt there was this male voice missing, and tried singing it alone myself and it didn't work, and I was just like, there's something missing. And then by the end, once I'd kind of done all the music and the song was completely finished except for this missing part, I sent it to him, and we had a really nice email exchange where he sort of asked me my inspiration and what I wanted from him, and to tell him about the characters of the song and the imagery. And he was just really like generous and really into it, and like really tried really hard to put across the character I wanted.
Bat for Lashes, and Two Sons is out on the 6th of April.
All right, from Natasha Khan to Natasha, can't believe you chose that record. It's so rubbish. Yes, it's time for Singles Club. And joining Rosie and I in the pod this week is Folky's favourite, Laura Barton.
Hello, Paul.
How are you?
Folky.
How's it going in your world? Has anybody threatened to plug anything in?
God, no.
God, no. Good. Well, we're going to start with your choice. We're just going to go right into the music. It's Wild Birds and Peace Drums, and There Is No Light.
There is no light, there is no light. My eyelids ache from too much darkness. No light, save me the night. Crave me the steep edges to look up for hope. Because if we fall, we never rise again. So what do we find in this?
That was There Is No Light by Wild Birds and Peace Drums. Mariam Valentin and Andreas Verlin are a couple from Sweden who met at music college, soon got married, and now solve crime under the alias of Wild Birds and Peace Drums. They also make primal, powerful music with Mariam on vocals and Andreas on percussion. Hopefully, she will team up with Amadou's other half and make music as Mariam and Mariam. That is my wish. It may not be yours, Laura Barton.
No, I'd like her to stay where she is. I saw this band earlier this year, and it was the best gig I've seen this year by a country mile. I don't think it's quite translated to record yet, but to see them live is just, it's so energetic and they're so involved and it's so contagious. It kind of feels like being at a carnival and or at some kind of medieval wake or something at the same time. It's just, they're amazing. She's not just doing the vocals. She also plays stuff. She plays the glockenspiel and the zither, and she's just hitting things and climbing up on stuff.
I mean, something that really comes across even on record on this track is the energy of it all. Does it compensate this energy for a lack of like melody, perhaps?
It feels more melodious, I think, when you actually see them live. You pick up on that more. And this track, I don't know, I think I chose this one actually particularly because it gives the closest energy to the kind of slightly chaotic nature of them live.
It makes me think of an army coming over the hill being led by a witch doctor.
Good.
Yes, thank you. Rosie.
Yes.
What does it make you think of?
Well, I guess what it made me think of straight away was Return of the Giant Slits by the Slits, that era of cacophonous kind of punk, post-punk, and I guess a little bit the Cocteau Twins, but that's more, I went on and listened to My Heart, which I think is, from what you were saying about the melody, it starts off in that very ramshackle way and then builds into something, and it's really hypnotic and amazing. I think this is absolutely great, and yet again, Laura Barton brings something to the pod which I've never heard of before and don't know anything about. You know, the fact that this is just more or less her voice and percussion could be totally lame, but it's, I don't know, it's the way it's arranged, and the power behind it just makes it really good. I think it's a brilliant record.
These sorts of adjectives so early in Singles Club. That is There Is No Light by Wild Birds and Peace Drums, and it's from The Snake, the band's second album, which is out on April the 13th. Second track on Singles Club is Never Believe You by Mavado.
Girl, me love how you are gone. Me can't wait for you in me arm. From your barn, yeah. Me never believe you when you say to get a squeeze. Whoa, she back it up on me. Me love her, she back it up on me. Whoa, whoa. Girl, I'm them stiff. Make my lad me out, that's a chief. Drop it up like a bit.
That's Mavado with Never Believe You. Not to be confused with South African Kwaito artist Mujava or Waitrose home delivery service Ocado, Mavado is a Jamaican dancehall reggae artiste of some repute. Mavado's born name is David Constantine Brooks. His nickname, though, is Gully God, which basically means chief executive of criminal activity in the ghetto. He was once pushed through a plate glass window at his local police station. Final fact there, Rosie.
Yes, this is mine. I'm probably going to overstate this massively, but he's pretty much the biggest dancehall artist in Jamaica, apparently. Never been there, so I'm told. What I like about Mavado is that actually, compared to a lot of his peers, he's relatively progressive in his samples. I mean, this, when I first heard it, I think kind of almost sounds like an 80s acid, you know, sample right at the beginning, that kind of almost like piano loop type thing. Before that, he did a song recently called All the Things, which has this manic violin loop going throughout it. It's just quite weird. And, I, you know, stylistically, he's kind of straddled the ground between being a notorious troublemaker, and he has this feud with Vybz Kartel, and he's a bit of trouble, but he also occasionally has quite remarkable lyrics that set him apart from his peers, who are just sort of more, in my opinion, like rave MCs or something like that.
So is that remarkable in terms of the flow, or in terms of, is he making political?
It's not really political, but I think there's like a real division between dancehall MCs, which is you're either Rastafarian and that's totally spiritual, or it's like, you know, sexual and all that sort of stuff. And he kind of, I mean, other than someone like maybe Sizzler, who sort of does that as well, he straddles that middle ground where he makes you think that he's not singing or rapping, because there's a bit of both, about a life that you can't empathise with.
Laura Barton, you got any idea of what he's saying when he's talking about getting dart in a debate?
Yeah, but I couldn't say it.
I
didn't expect to like this record. Well, initially I was concerned by the sort of the samples and the 80s-ness of it. Not that I hated the 80s. It grew on me like really, really quickly. And no, I think it's great.
What is it? What is it that grows? Because I quite like the piano.
Yeah, it's the piano and the strings. I'm a sucker for strings, but like, it's a combination of the two. I think is fantastic. And also, his voice sounds as if it's from a totally different era. I found that really moving. The church background seemed to make sense to me. It sounded not gospel exactly, but it did sound churchy somehow.
The 80s thing I got was like a Harold Faltermeyer, though, like Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack.
Yeah, no, definitely.
But I liked it for that. Okay, Never Believe You by Mavado is on the album Mr. Brooks, which is out now. Final track on Singles Club is I Can't Get Away by Stardeath and White Dwarfs. Stardeath and White Dwarfs with I Can't Get Away. With such an intergalactic name, it may not surprise you to hear that Stardeath and White Dwarfs features Wayne Coyne's nephew Dennis on vocals. The band also shares psychedelic stylings with Coyne Sr. and hail from his home state of Oklahoma. So why not just call themselves Flaming Lips Juniors and be done with it? That is a question I cannot answer, but what I can tell you is this. I think this track is very funky. That's why I like it. It's got a Clintonian bass. By that, I mean Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, of course, not old Funkadelic man George. It gives this tune something of a swagger, and that's generally something I'm in favour with in tracks, unless it comes from Kasabian. But also, crucially, it kind of holds the entire track together. I'm not sure whether I think this is a sign of genius or them just kind of skating above the bar, but basically everything else, the vocals, the keyboards, and what might be glockenspiel parts are noodling all over the place in small little loops. And that's something you might expect from a band of stoners, as I believe this group to be. I think it comes in just the right side of charming for me, and the funk just makes it work. Rosie.
I like this. I mean, it's very Flaming Lips, but actually what it has, which I don't think the Flaming Lips concentrate on that much, is it's got that groove, what you were talking about with the bass line. That's where I think they might sound the most different from something that the Flaming Lips would do. They called themselves in a recent interview a psychedelic drug band, and I think you can definitely hear that in the kind of fizz and the swirling quality that they create in this track that works so well because they've underpinned it with that very straight, direct bass line. And that's what I think is really good about it. I mean, they sort of cite Yes and King Crimson as influences in this same interview, which I'm not sure you can totally hear in this one, maybe some of the rest of their stuff. But yeah, no, it's good.
As is quite often with these things, I think this is a lead single. It was doled out on 7-inch, whether it will be entirely representative of any output that's yet to come. Laura.
The first time I heard this, I thought it was almost as if you had designed a song for yourself. I can even imagine.
Maybe I have. Maybe I've do design and released them under a variety of pseudonyms like Phil Collins. You'd never know.
It reminds me of 808 State a little bit.
Oh, really?
Weirdly.
A bit baggy, is it?
It's a bit baggy. I don't know. I do really, really like it. I agree. It may not, having listened to the other tracks on their MySpace, which sounds far more Flaming Lips, which interestingly is called Smoking Pot Makes Me Not Want to Kill Myself.
That's where I deduced the whole stony thing
from. Yeah, that's where I got the clues too. That sounded more spacey. But yeah, no, I think it's really nice.
They said that they came up with the name because Star Death is some kind of ecstasy tablet. Incidentally, I think the name is the worst thing about them.
Yeah,
well, particularly ropey. Since it's kind of repeating the same thing, you know, like White Dwarf is a dead star. So, you know, it's kind of like two, if they were hanging out in a bar together, they wouldn't really have a lot to say to each other, Star Death and White Dwarf. But that possibility might never occur. Ooh, psychedelic thoughts there, guys. But that is Star Death and White Dwarfs, and it's available to buy on 7-inch single over the interwebulars. Some of your reviews now of last week's tracks. Take Courage said of the Horrors track, Sea Within a Sea, it's a revelation, such a big idea, executed with a casual majesty. Nice phrasing. Like the video, but found it let down by a couple of cliche moments. For example, the unfortunate T4 style staccato shots of the band members' legs from various angles around 3 minutes in. Somebody watches too much hangover TV there.
Falling and Laughing said, I always thought the Horrors had something more than the dirge on their first album, and their choice of new producer looks inspired.
Sol says, the Horrors single is great. Based on their previous output, is this the true Horrors I see before me, or a certain Mr. Barrow's influence coming to the fore? Rosie, is Jeff Barrow of Portishead, who we much like on this pod, this producer on the whole album?
I think on that particular track, you can really hear it.
Yeah.
You know, when it gets to that synthy bit in the last like 6 minute or something like that, it sounds almost exactly like the loop from Portishead's The Rip. But the rest of the album, I think, kind of just takes off where they left with the first one. Loads of retro influences done in their own particular way. So I'm not sure whether his influence... I'd love to have seen the conversations between them, however, can you imagine? In fact, I know that, you know, Jeff Barrow, he's got young children, likes to come in and work at this hour day. The Horrors, well, not like, so much.
Their coffins haven't even opened by
I've got to go home now and put my kids to bed.
All right, well, that's your comments on last week's stuff, but you can head to guardian.co.uk/musicweekly to post your comments on this week's tracks from the longest names in history that you don't need to rehear, and Movado. Anyone who posts reviews of White Dwarfs and Wild Birds by accident will be forgiven, however. There are other tracks out to buy next week, though, and here they are. Art Brute, Alcoholics Unanimous.
Slept on my face and woke up confused. A bit concerned about what I've been up to. I mean, I'd love to get to know you.
Franz Ferdinand, Know You Girls.
Do you ever wonder? No, 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 you girls never know. Oh, no, you girls never know. No, you.
Up for the weekend and blame God for looking too old.
Calvin Harris, I'm Not Alone.
Can you find all that you stand for has been replaced with mountains of gold?
Try Konami Radio Radio. Thanks to Laura Barton.
Thank you for having me.
For coming in to join us in Singles Club today.
Sorry.
You just get in there whenever you want. I know you're a busy woman. Don't forget you can catch up with a larger, expanded, texticular version of Singles Club each Wednesday at guardian.co.uk Music, where you can watch the videos too. Next on Music Weekly, sometimes it's time to interview Erasure. Sometimes by Erasure. Synth pop may be back in fashion, but Erasure were making it the first time around. A duo comprised of keyboard whiz Vince Clark and vocalist Andy Bell, they formed in 1985 and by 1992 had enough hits to release a 20-strong best of collection. This year, they're releasing a follow-up with 40 of the fellas. Now, when Andy Bell came in for interview, we sent our own power duo to chat. Did we not, Rosie Swash?
Indeed we did. Both myself and Tim Jones, no irony intended, are huge Erasure fans. We established this quite early on in our friendship that we both absolutely loved Erasure. And quite frankly, who doesn't? I remember Bob Mills, of all people, on his radio show, not that I listen, I just caught a little snatch, actually saying this is one of the best songs ever written before we played Sometimes. So I think there's more fans of them out there in weirder places than you'd expect, which is why, contrary to current fashion, when we just have one person interviewing a guest or a band, both Tim and I decided to tackle him together, and he was a little bit freaked out. Famously, you saw the Vince Clark's advert in Melody Maker.
Yeah, I've been in London a few years then, and I had been in a band called The Void, and that was just kind of a back garden rehearsing in the garage kind of thing. I looked in the music papers and saw the Vince advert. It didn't say it was him. And they also, it was filled up on that weekend for the auditions, and they said they'd call me back, which I didn't think they would, but then they did. And I was over the moon.
You were the 36th person.
43rd.
43rd, was it?
Yeah.
43rd.
Yeah.
So I mean, obviously he was after a specific kind of, you know, he wasn't just going to take
Yeah, I think it was Vince was quite frustrated because he said that they were mostly cabaret-ish type singers that came along and older. And I thought my voice was fantastic when I was younger. You know, I thought my voice was as good as Elvis, and I thought I was going to, like, change the world and sell millions and millions of records and stuff like that. Now I kind of realise,
you
know...
But you have sold millions and millions
A few. But now, you kind of have to put it all in perspective, and I think, well, actually, it's not that strong, your voice, you know, and you can... I mean, I can do live gigs and things like that in June and dance and things like that, but you do get very carried away when you're younger.
So what did you think when you turned up and you saw Vince Clark there? Did that put a lot of pressure on, or did you even know who he was? Or
yeah, I mean, I was a huge Vince Clark fan.
Okay.
And I had seen him once. I'd been for an audition for a Bow Wow Wow spin-off band, and Vince was there in Blackwing Studios, which he used to half own, I think. And I saw him, and he was like one of the first famous people that I saw. And I was like, wow, that's Vince Clark, you know, on the Space Invaders machine. And then, so he'd kind of been in my mind's eye. And then after Yazoo split, which I was a huge fan of, I said, oh, maybe I should write Vince a letter and see if he needs a new singer. But I didn't know where to write to or anything. So when this advert came up and it happened to be him, I just thought, well, this is it. This is meant to be. But I was very, very nervous of him, and he was... And they were quite laddish in the studio, even though they're trying to make me feel comfortable. And they said they kind of had an inkling that I might have been gay because all these young boys kept coming round to the studio to visit me. You know?
At that point, did he have an idea of what he wanted from Erasure? Or was it just, I want to start a new project?
Well, he was trying the Assembly, and this was a project which was going to be him writing with all these different singers doing the songs, a bit like Soul to Soul did later on. But at the time it didn't work out. So Flood, who we did the first album with, said to Vince, you better get a full-time singer again.
you said Vince might have had an inkling you were gay, but Erasure became such a, you know, big band for the gay community.
Yeah.
I just wondered, you know, what that felt like at the time, because it must have been quite exciting when it was
really exciting. I don't think there's ever been as an exciting period in my life. You know, we were going to Gay Pride, it was free then, and it was on the South Bank, you know, and Erasure had just started, and Jimmy Somerville was around with the Communards, you know, we'd had the Bronx Beat and Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and so it was this whole gay political movement, you know, and we were going on marches all the time. We had this this pub called The Bell, where everything was organised from in King's Cross, and we're doing collections for Solidarity from Poland, in Poland, and all sorts of things going on, you know, and the anti-clause 28 march, you know, and some homophobic policemen in Rugby were marching against them, and all kinds of things. So we really got carried away with the whole wave going on, you know, and it was really exciting.
I had an interview with John Savage a while ago, because he brought out a new wave electro compilation, which is really brilliant. Yazoo were on there, because obviously he's known as a punk journalist, you know, mainly. And I said to him, you know, what is it about this period of music in Britain, as much as anywhere else, that really made it so wonderful? And he said because it was such a reaction as to what came before.
Yeah.
Do you? I mean, you talked a little bit about that before in terms of the political, you know, the gay rights movement and stuff like that. Would you agree with that?
I think so. I mean, for me, it was kind of like not that it was a backlash against punk, but it was kind of the same thing, because as Vince said, you know, he couldn't play guitar. So he bought a synthesizer, and found out that you could make really amazing music with it, and in your bedroom, you know. I remember, and when I first heard the Human League, I mean, I didn't hear their previous albums, but when I first heard Dare, I thought it was fantastic, you know, and Soft Cell, and so raw as well in some ways, and also the electronic music has always remained underground for some reason. Pop bands use it, and they use synthesizers and things to kind of embellish their songs, you know, make them commercial. But the hardcore electro has always been underground, and I really love that. I love going to clubs and hearing the electronic music on big amps in the clubs and things. It goes right through your bones. It's the same for me when I'm on stage performing live with Vince's music. It literally rattles your bones and goes inside your body, and I think it couldn't do that because that's kind of some reflection of the music itself and what it stands for.
So which Erasure songs do you think are the perfect first kind of blasting out on a big
For blasting out, I would say the songs that work like that live, I think it's going to be something like Chorus and You Surround Me, and there's something with like with a huge bass on them.
Depeche Mode are coming back with something, Pet Shop Boys are back, and then you've got all these young women, mainly, like, you know, Lady Hawk, Little Boots, obviously influenced by that kind of music.
It's not just the kind of musicians who are kind of coming back, because I've noticed when I DJ out, if I ever put a little Respect on or stop, it is without doubt the most popular record of the night. So it's kind of almost like, you know, you've gone from being a massive selling band in the 80s and the early 90s to kind of fading away a bit to now becoming a real hipster reference point.
Yeah.
Is that quite satisfying?
It is, yeah. I really like that. You know, I really like the fact that we've got our hardcore audience. You know, when we were really, really popular, you kid yourself that all those people really, really like you because they bought those records and they're going to be with you forever, but they're not. They kind of like buy what's ever in the charts and things, or if you're on the TV all the time, which we're not now. That sort of like dies down, and it's almost like you have to wait for a new generation to come along and that haven't heard it through their mum or their dad and discover it for themselves, you know, and like take it on face value, which is really cool.
What do you think that you would be doing now if you hadn't have got that audition with Vince Clarke?
If I hadn't got the audition, I think I would have carried on. I probably would have been in another band, or I might have joined a choir, or I might have gone into theatre or into light opera or something like that. Vince is a great bloke. He's a really brilliant person, and I think he's really kept my feet on the floor, on the ground, because I can be misled quite easily, you know. So he's been very good.
That was Andy Bell from Erasure and Total Pop. The First 40 Hits is out now, and an extended interview with Mr. Bell can be found in the same place you found this interview, as a Music Weekly extra.
No one expects the feature with no name, and so it is this week, as it arrives upon us like a thief in the night with a taste for uproarious Brazilian psychedelia. This is John Dennis of the Guardian Daily podcast on Os Mutantes.
In the 1960s, it seems every country had their own version of the Beatles. In Brazil, it was Os Mutantes. They combined Sgt. Pepper-style studio experimentation, the psychedelia of American West Coast rock bands like Jefferson Airplane, and the funky head music of Sly and the Family Stone, as well as Brazilian styles like Bossa Nova. They first surfaced on a weekly television programme, variously dressed up as aliens or witches, singing songs about such figures as Genghis Khan or Lucifer. As they played, huge nets or giant rubber caterpillars would be tossed across their audience. So, not exactly the Alan Titchmarsh show then. Os Mutantes were part of the Tropicália movement, a group of artists, writers and musicians that included Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil. They were regularly censored for challenging their country's brutal right-wing dictatorship with absurdist art, confrontational theatre and psychedelic rock, all filtered through the lens of a very Brazilian counterculture. But you don't need a master's in Brazilian political history or to understand Portuguese to respond to the life-affirming warmth of Os Mutantes, endlessly inventive and even at their most subversive, always with a sense of fun. Lee left Os Mutantes in 1972 for a solo career, and the band were further weakened by the fragile mental health of Arnaldo Batista, who was a kind of Brazilian Sid Barrett. Os Mutantes' influence spread far beyond Latin America. Beck has claimed he listened to little else but Os Mutantes for several years, while Kurt Cobain reportedly wrote to Arnaldo Batista requesting that Os Mutantes reunite. More recent fans include Devendra Banhart, who joined them on stage at their reunion at the Barbican a few years ago, and The Bees, whose version of Amina Menina has some of the joie de vivre of the original. I first heard Os Mutantes when David Byrne's Luarca Bop label released a compilation. In 2006, Os Mutantes reunited without Rita Lee for the Tropicália season at London's Barbican. It was a joyous occasion, with at least half the audience Brazilians, who must have thought they'd never get to see their own Lennon-McCartney on stage together again.
John Dennis of the Guardian Daily podcast on Os Mutantes. Post comments on this week's blog. Tell us what you made of Bat for Lashes and Erasure and all our tracks and the feature with no name. And you can do so at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. We are back next Friday. Register now to get the podcast sent straight to your computer or MP3 player for free. look us up on Facebook. We're Music Weekly. We've got a weirdo page that we haven't quite worked out yet because everybody's having trouble with a new Facebook. But we'll be there and you can listen to all our shows there too. That's all for this week. See you next week. Bye.